Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to the first part of a talk by Dr. Francis Fukuyama, a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University. He delivered the talk at the Yale Institute for Social and Policy Studies on January the 22nd, 2003, reprising the themes of his book, Our Post-Human Future. Dr. Fukuyama serves on the President's Council on Bioethics and is a well-known conservative intellectual and also author of The End of History.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Art Galston, the director of the Bioethics and Public Policy Seminar Series, sponsored by the Institution for Social and Policy Studies. Our speaker today is probably well-known and needs not too much of an introduction. And there are many things to say about him. I won't say them all, but let me just outline a few. Our speaker is Francis Fukuyama. He's Dean of the Faculty and Bernard L. Schwartz Professor of International Political Economy at the Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. He has done many things in his life, but one thing that brought him to prominence was his book of about a decade ago called The End of History and the Last Man, which has appeared in over 20 foreign editions. It made the bestseller lists in U.S., France, Japan, and Chile, and was awarded the Los Angeles Times Book Critics Award in the current interest category. He's written several other books, but most recently he's written on Our Post-Human Future, Consequences of the Biotechnology Revolution. It was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in April of 2002. So he spaced nicely his two great blockbusters a decade apart. What will 2012 bring? Dr. Fukuyama is interested in questions concerning democratization and international political economy. And he's in recent years, he's focused on the role of culture and social capital in modern economic life, and on the social consequences of a transition to an information economy. He received his BA from Cornell in classics, his PhD from Harvard in political science, and he's been at various places and times, members of RAND Corporation, policy planning staff of the U.S. Department of State, where he was a specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, and then he was deputy director for European political military affairs. And he was even a delegate to the Egyptian-Israeli talks on Palestinian autonomy. He's also recently been a member of the well-known President's Council on Bioethics, chaired by Leon Kass, which has been in the news quite a bit recently. So this afternoon, he's going to speak to us on our post-human future. Francis?
Well, thank you very much. I feel a little bit awkward being up in this dais looking down on all of you. I wish it were a little bit less formal, but I guess since we're being recorded, I can't walk around Oprah Winfrey style amongst you. But thank you, Professor Galston, very much for that that introduction. Hearing my own biography emphasizes to me the need to explain to you why I got interested in these questions of biotechnology in the first place, because I think nothing in my background would suggest that I this was a natural intellectual line of development for me. And let me explain how this, in fact, grew directly out of the book that Dr. Galston mentioned, The End of History and the Last Man, from about a decade ago, for the following reason. The End of History was really, the End of History in the title of that book refers to Hegel's end of history, which was actually a term appropriated then by Karl Marx and is in a sense embedded in the popular culture. This is the idea that there is such a thing as human history writ large. There is progress over time as societies evolve from hunter-gatherer to agricultural to industrial to post-industrial societies, and that there are a variety of political forms. And my argument was that whereas most progressive intellectuals for the past 150 years, or at least up until 1989 or so, had believed that that historical progress was going to lead to a socialist utopia, I simply observed that it wasn't going there, and in fact it was going to end up in something like liberal democracy and market-oriented economies. And that was the basic hypothesis of the book. Now, one of the reasons that I believe that we ended up with this result at the end of the 20th century, this set of political institutions, was that in a sense, ever since the French Revolution, there's been this constant stream of utopian political movement. The French Revolution itself, the Bolshevik, Chinese, Cambodian, Cuban, other revolutions that have sought to remake human societies along lines that were ideally just and sought to impose that pattern on real-world human societies. And there are a number of reasons why that project, that utopian project, failed, but in my view, one of the important reasons was actually the existence of something like human nature. For example, Marxism-Leninism wanted to, in some sense, abolish people's allegiance to the family and to private property, and to subordinate human loyalties to the party or to the state. One of the reasons that those societies failed in that project was that they bumped up against this wall of human nature, that people simply weren't wired to put distant causes of Vietnamese people over their own kin. They liked having private property, and so therefore those institutions, the attempt to create those kinds of institutions, failed. And the thought occurred to me, I was actually asked to write on this subject 10 years after the original article, The End of History, what had changed, in my view, to make me rethink this hypothesis. And one of the things that changed is really the march of technology, and in particular a lot of the developments that were coming out of the life sciences. Because, in some sense, the ability to do the kind of ambitious social engineering or to manipulate human behavior in the way that 20th century politics had dictated had to make use of very crude technologies, things like labor camps and agitation and propaganda, early childhood socialization, Freudianism. I mean, there are a lot of things both in totalitarian and democratic societies that were meant to shape and structure human behavior, and most of these had simply failed because they did not sufficiently understand the real sources of human behavior. And it did seem to me that it was worth thinking and worrying a little bit about whether the tools were simply inadequate and whether with a better cognitive neuroscience, with a better understanding of the human genome, with the kinds of, for example, pharmacological agents that are now, available in psychiatry, whether some of these goals might not be rethought. And so that was, in a certain sense, the background. And my concern, and a lot of the debate over stem cells and cloning over the past couple of years, has centered on moral status of the embryo and questions, therefore, related to abortion. I think that this is an unfortunate emphasis, because although that is the chief issue, I think, with something like stem cells or therapeutic cloning, I believe that there is a much broader set of issues or challenges raised by future biotechnology that go way beyond anything having to do with embryos. So what I want to do with you today is go over what I think some of those future possibilities are. Some of those possibilities are actually realities in the area of, let's say, neuropharmacology. Others have yet to materialize. Some may never materialize. But all of them, I think, have important political implications and therefore require certain kinds of political solutions. And I want to make a case for why, let me say at the outset, this revolution, the technological revolution that we are in the midst of, is one of tremendous promise for therapeutic purposes. And I think many diseases that we could only palliate the symptoms of will actually be able to cure in the coming years and decades. And so, there is obviously a very, very positive core to this. But what I want to outline are some concerns, particularly with the non-therapeutic uses of some of these technologies that I believe will have political consequences. So let me go over three what I call pathways to the future, against a background really of a certain revolution in our thinking of the sources of human behavior, which is, in a way, the biologization of our understanding of why humans behave the way they do. That's kind of the background condition for a lot of the technological developments. And then the three paths are neuropharmacology, second, life extension, and the third, genetic engineering proper. And I should note that when most people think about future biotechnology, they're thinking about genetic engineering or germline engineering. This is only the third of three pathways, and it's actually one that may never technologically materialize. But I think that the problems that I want to discuss really are not dependent on the emergence of that particular set of technologies. So let me go over it. Let me start just with the cognitive revolution, which requires a little bit of background in the intellectual history in a certain sense of the 20th century. The century began, I think with the after effects of the Darwinian revolution, in which people's understanding of human behavior was heavily tilted towards the nature side of the nature-nurture dichotomy. And so there was a lot of thinking about that was quite determinist, genetically determinist in its account of social behavior. Behaviors like criminality, alcoholism, poverty were frequently attributed to genetic causes. And there was, in fact, perfectly respectable academic study of what's now known as scientific racism, which is the genetic, the allegedly genetic origins of different outcomes, social outcomes among ethnic groups, races. The stratification of the world was explained and to some extent justified in genetic terms. Now, that intellectual climate at the beginning of the 20th century underwent a, as we know, dramatic revolution that was pushed forward by many of the excesses that it brought about. This was, the origins of eugenics movement that occurred. Virtually all developed democracies, the United States, had laws, that forcibly sterilized so-called morons and imbeciles, prohibited them coercively from reproducing and having children. These practices were carried to an extreme by Nazism that really was what ultimately undermined that whole intellectual tendency in explanations of human behavior, and the pendulum swung back over to what was by mid-century, I believe, a fairly, in a way, equally extreme belief in the social causes of human behavior, so that we went from an extreme nature view to an extreme nurture view, which was reflected in things like the behavioralism of Watson or B.F. Skinner, and in fact a great deal of social policy from the middle of the 20th century forward in the next few decades was founded on the belief that it was essentially the socialization and the social environment that accounted for human behavior, so an extreme form of social constructionism. Now, the background for the current biotech revolution is really, again, a swinging back of the pendulum, hopefully not, all the way back to the bad old days of scientific racism, but I think to a more appropriate middle position in which there has been a reassertion of the fact that there are certain aspects of our behavior that are determined biologically. And biological does not necessarily mean genetic. I mean, there are certain things that are determined by genes, but there are other things that are determined by the complex interaction of genes and environment that can be said to be biological. So the hormonal level and the state of, various neurotransmitters in your brain are not genetically controlled, but they are biological and therefore subject to manipulation. And that, I think, is a very uncomfortable revolution for a lot of people, because it has raised, the possibility that there are certain aspects of human social behavior that are outside of the control of individuals or outside of the control of, the ability of social policy to shape. And so, we've had controversies in the past 10 years over, for example, the publication of the Herrnstein-Murray book, The Bell Curve, in which they argued that IQ is anywhere between, 60 and 70% hereditary. What we know about the relative contribution of genes and environment to things like IQ at this point comes entirely out of studies of monozygotic twins, within the discipline of behavior genetics. This is what Marie and Herrnstein based their assertions on. They made, the assertion not only that there was that high degree of heritability of IQ, but also that racial differences, measurable differences between the races were also likely to be genetically caused. Now, this, needless to say, caused an enormous outcry and charges of racism and attempt to revive eugenics. It led to the publication of several actually very interesting review volumes that surveyed what is known actually about the role of genetics in IQ, including, I think, a very important one by the American psychologist. And what was interesting about a lot of the more serious attempts to review that literature, the less polemical ones, was that there actually, was not a dispute that there was an important genetic component to something like IQ. I think most of the rest of the discipline of psychology would put the figure at more like 40-50% rather than 60-70%, as in Murray and Herrnstein and Murray's view. But, you can see the glass is either half full or half empty. There is still an important genetic component that is not manipulable, therefore, by environment. I think in terms of race, it's much more likely, the consensus view is that that is not very likely to be genetics. But the fact that a certain proportion of it is something that remains highly politically charged, and there are many other forms of behavior. Criminality, for example, I think prima facie, there has to be a genetic component to criminal behavior simply because of this, obvious fact that vast result of crimes are committed by young men between the ages of about 15 and 25 or 30. This is invariant over time, it's invariant over cultures, which leads you to a very strong suspicion that there must be some sex-linked element to the kinds of, attitudes towards risk-taking and time horizons that is at the root of certain forms of criminal behavior. So all of this is behavior that is information that is politically relevant that has been generated really out of the life sciences through people that don't have a particular, this may not be true in Murray and Herrnstein's case, but, the bulk of this behavior, for example, in behavior genetics is generated by people that don't have a particular ideological agenda, and yet it has, I think, important ideological consequences.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, you're listening to a talk by Dr. Francis Fukuyama reprising the themes of his book, Our Post-Human Future. His talk was delivered January 22, 2003 at Yale University.
Now that is the broad background, that there are, there's an increasingly scientific understanding of the brain and therefore of the sources, certain biological sources of human behavior. And this leads to the possibility, therefore, I think obviously, of the ability to manipulate that behavior through technology. And this is the point at which I think a certain set of political concerns begin to kick in. Now, let me go over the three pathways, beginning with neuropharmacology. I think it's safe to say that in the, one of the fascinating things, at least about American intellectual life in the last 50 years, is that Freud and Freudianism have really been killed as viable intellectual ways of thinking about human psychology and human behavior. It's much less true in Europe. It actually strikes me as one of the big differences between European and American views of Freudianism in a country like France actually remains much more respectable. But certainly in American psychiatry, the psychological interpretation of behavior that is inherent in Freudianism has been displaced by an increasingly biological interpretation of psychological events. And part of that really grows out of the clinical practice of psychiatry where, the discovery of lithium and various other drugs used to treat serious mental disorder proved to be very effective, indicating that there was, in fact, a biological basis for these behaviors, that they were simply not mental or psychological artifacts. And, in fact, there has been the growth of a large group of chemicals that affect particularly ones that affect levels of neurotransmitters in the brain that have important effects on human behavior. The two that I find actually the most interesting are Prozac and Ritalin. Prozac affects it's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter that I think is inherently political because it has to do with people's sense of self-esteem or self-respect, which is why low levels of serotonin, brain serotonin, are commonly associated with depression. And conversely, for example, in a troop of monkeys, the monkey that wins alpha male status, you know, has measurably higher levels of brain serotonin than the males that lose in that competition. And the manipulation of brain serotonin has been very effective in the treatment of depression. Now, this is interesting, you know, coming from this particular Hegelian perspective that I started with in the end of history. For Hegel, most of politics is actually a struggle over recognition. It's actually not a struggle over the division of economic resources so much as a struggle over respect. The degree of respect that people, that other people in an intersubjective context pay to you, to your gods, to your sense of identity. And I think that you can see in politics, if you think about gender politics or race, the politics of race or the politics of nationalism, all of these really have at their core the absence of respect on the part of one group or individuals for another group or individuals. It's really not an economic struggle at all. But it turns out that one's feeling, one's subjective feeling of esteem or respect is, you know, due in these circumstances to intersubjective interaction of people in society, but also is due to a simple brain chemical, and that you can, you know, you can achieve in a certain sense the same subjective feeling of esteem through this chemical shortcut. And it raises some very interesting and I think potentially troubling questions. For example, if we traditionally regard esteem or self-esteem as something that is not simply an entitlement, but something that has to be earned by doing acts that are estimable, then what does it mean to have a chemical shortcut that gives you the esteem without having to have the preceding behavior that produces the estimable acts? Does it devalue, therefore, the, you know, feelings of esteem that one, you know, traditionally has thought one rightly experiences as a result of doing something that that is esteemed? Now, if you take a different drug, Ritalin, it poses, I think, a different, in a way, a different set of questions that, again, I think are inherently political. Ritalin is a type of amphetamine, not entirely unrelated to, you know, to kind of speed that was used in Haight-Ashbury in the 1960s. It is used to treat a condition known as ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. ADHD, like many psychiatric disorders, is actually, you know, the way of classifying this as a disorder, it's completely different in psychiatry than it is in somatic medicine. It's something that you only know through its symptoms. And in fact, like many disorders, it actually does not describe a clearly pathological state. What it is the tale of a normal distribution of behaviors having to do with the ability of particularly young boys, but, you know, children more broadly, concentrate, to sit still, to pay attention in social situations. And when you get sufficiently far out into the tail of that distribution, there are some diagnostic criteria that are in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, that is the tool that's used by the psychiatric profession to classify disorders. If you meet a certain, you know, fairly subjective and squishy criteria, a doctor can say that you have this condition, ADHD, for which Ritalin is prescribed. Now, this is, I think, problematic for the following reason. I think there is no question that, you know, if you get far enough out into the tail of those behaviors, that you have attention deficit of a magnitude that it really, you know, makes impossible any kind of normal life. And I think most reasonable people would say that is a, you know, that's a serious condition that needs treated therapeutically. And if you have a drug that can do it, then that's, you know, that's an appropriate way of doing it. The problem is that it actually, you know, helps anybody. You and I mean, assuming that we're not diagnosed as ADHD adults, I mean, any of us would actually be able to concentrate better if we took Ritalin. Maybe I should have done that prior to this lecture. But the point is that, you know, it has, you know, a similar effect regardless of where you stand on that curve. And it's a particularly difficult question of knowing what the difference between enhancement and therapy is in that case. And there are certain people like Lawrence Diller, who has written extensively on, you know, the rise of Ritalin. I mean, the statistics on Ritalin are actually quite amazing. I mean, there are probably, you know, in the order of, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 million American children that are now diagnosed as being having ADHD and getting this drug. Diller's estimate is that of that group, as many as 7 out of 8 actually do not have, you know, by the strictest criteria, really can't be said to have ADHD, so that there's actually a lot of overprescribing of this drug in ways that end up, you know, essentially being a way of controlling behavior, not therapy for a clear-cut pathological condition, but a drug that is really being used to control behavior. And again, I think this has certain implications for our understanding of, you know, how parents relate to children, how society socializes children and the like. The traditional understanding by character is that it is a process of, you know, habit and social adjustment by which children are taught to put, you know, immediate gratifications off in favor of longer term objectives, to develop self-control and discipline and the like. And in certain cases, now, and again, I don't want to at all, you know, deny the legitimacy of therapeutic uses of this drug, but there are other cases in which the drug can be used for non-therapeutic reasons as a shortcut, essentially to achieve purposes of self-control by school districts or teachers or in other cases possibly parents who simply don't want or have the time to, you know, apply more traditional techniques of socialization and child rearing. And so again, you get a chemical shortcut to achieve something that was understood in moral terms, and the replacement of a therapeutic language to substitute for the moral language that we used to talk about this, you know, a certain category of behavior. And it's also a good illustration, I think, of the, you know, the enormously expanding domain of the therapeutic, because ADHD was not even recognized as a disease 25 years ago. It entered the DSM and the official lexicon at a certain point, and in a certain sense, it's a good example of a socially constructed disease.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we've been listening to a talk by Dr. Francis Fukuyama, which he delivered at the Yale Institute for Social and Policy Studies on January the 22nd, 2003, reprising the themes of his book, Our Post-Human Future. For the second part of his talk, check back next week on Change Surfer Radio, or listen to it at changesurfer.com in streaming MP3. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.